Damnation comes through the body, and salvation comes through the body. And your spirit is in many ways following your body.
Welcome to Act in Line, a product of the Acton Institute for the Study of Religion and Liberty. I'm Eric Cohn, executive producer. One Mardi Gras night in 1520s Paris, college students Jean Calvin, founder of Calvinism and autocratic ruler of Geneva, Ignatius of Loyola, founder of the Counter-Reformation Catholic religious order, the Jesuits, and their bawdy friend Francois Rabelais, the humanist novelist, find themselves mixed up in a gruesome murder, and any one of them might be guilty. The ensuing investigation sparks a battle of wits and weapons, plunging them into questions of justice and mercy, grace and sin, innocence, guilt, love, and contempt. Before the bells ring in the start of Lent, they must confront the darkest parts of their souls and find the courage to pursue truth in a world that seems intent on obscuring it. Sonne la mattina, Jane Clark Charles' verse play, released in 2023, imagines what might have happened if these three brilliant, volatile men had to put their convictions to the test while navigating a brutal crime and their own involvement in it. In this episode, Noah Gould, Acton's alumni and student programs manager, talks with Charles about her play and the themes that it explores, including questions of justice, grace, sin, and the importance of the body. You can find additional resources in the show notes for this episode, as well as find previous episodes of Act in Line on our website at acton.org/actinline. And if you like this program, you can help us reach even more listeners by sharing it with a friend and leaving us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. We welcome your comments as well. Act in Line is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
Jane Clark Charles is an American poet, playwright, and critic. Her poetry has appeared in many American and European outlets, including the BBC, the Hopkins Review, the New Ohio Review, the American Journal of Poetry, The Lamp, Measure Review, and others. Her criticism has appeared in Dappled Things, Fair Forward, Plow Quarterly, as well as others. Her first verse drama, Sonne la mattina, was published by Wiseblood Books in February 2023. The play had its theatrical debut in New York City on February 21st, 2023 at the New Box Theater. She lives in Detroit with her husband and children. We're really thrilled to have you on today, Jane.
Thanks. I'm excited to be here.
I think our last conversation was in our other podcast, Act and Unwind, on your fantastic article on Cormac McCarthy. So I really enjoyed that conversation and happy to have you on our main stage production of Act in Line today.
So
I will put that essay in the show notes for everyone as well. But I want to dive into your new play, or new for our audience, Sonne la mattina, and this is a really interesting kind of exploration of a lot of themes through three characters. So tell us a little bit about just kind of the germ of the idea for this play. What was the first kind of idea that got you started?
Sure. So I was in Paris with my husband in 2017. We did kind of a late honeymoon to France, and we were walking around, and I just read in a tour book that John Calvin and St. Ignatius of Loyola studied at the same college, and they studied under Erasmus. And I just thought that was so interesting to have those great minds all in one place. And they likely overlapped by a little bit. So one place, one time. And then I love Rabelais. I've always loved Rabelais for years and years. And so then I started looking into it. And Rabelais is a little hard to track throughout history. It's hard to really know where he is specifically, especially in his early life, but it seems likely that he was in and around Paris at this time. So I just thought, oh my gosh, it'd be so fun to put all these characters in conversation with each other. So I batted around a lot of different forms for the idea. I thought about writing a novel. I'm not really strong in writing fiction though. And that I love writing dramatic monologues, verse dramatic monologues. That's my favorite form to write. So I was thinking, oh, maybe I'll write like a series of dramatic monologues. And then my husband, he was making fun of me. He's like, you know what that's called? That's called a play.
Yeah, we already have that. That exists already.
I don't have to admit this. So I just decided, let's try it as a play. And it seemed to work. In an early draft, Erasmus was also in it. But his presence kind of just distorted the balance of it, because he was such an authority figure because he was older and he was a teacher and all that. So he didn't make the final draft, but I hope I could work him into a play sometime, because he had a really fun voice to work in. It just didn't work in this play.
Yeah. It seems like a character study kind of at its core, and you have these three kind of, you call them friends at different points, although they're very different people. We have John Calvin, yeah. We have Rabelais, and then Ignatius. So when you thought about these characters, tell me a little bit about kind of the style that they speak in and what that says about them, during the course of the play. For our listeners, they discover a murder. So that's kind of the plot we get through the arc of the play. But it really seems to be about the interplay of their friendship and their back and forth about these various ideas. So tell me specifically about kind of how they speak and how that influences, their ideas in the play.
Sure. Yeah. So it's a verse play, for listeners who don't know that already, which means it's written all in poetry. And each of the characters speaks in their own form. So kind of in order of structure, you have John Calvin, who he speaks in what's called blank verse, which is it's metered, but there's no rhyme. And then periodically he actually slips into metered prose, where he's not actually speaking in verse at all anymore. There's just regular prose speech, but with a strong meter behind it. Then Ignatius of Loyola, he speaks in what's called alliterative verse. And it's actually a very distinctively English form of verse. And obviously the character is Spanish and living in France. So I kind of went back and forth on, okay, can I get away with this? But I just went for it because I write in English. So that's what I did. But it's a form it's associated with war, and it's called a martial form. It's kind of what you see in Beowulf. Now I'm not using the whole Anglo-Saxon form, which is a lot more complex than what I'm doing, but I do have the strong alliteration throughout Ignatius's work, and he is speaking in what's called tetrameter. So it has four pulses, four beats per line. Calvin has five beats per line. And then Rabelais, the third character, who's the one that people are generally least familiar with. Most people kind of go, oh, John Calvin, Ignatius of Loyola, and then who's this other guy? So Francois Rabelais, he speaks in metered and rhymed couplets. So his is the tightest form. It's five beats per line, and then each line rhymes with the one after it, and it's very bouncy, and it leads to a lot of comedy because of the rhymes that he chooses. They're often they're either bawdy or just kind of silly, and yeah. So he's got the most rigorous form that he's speaking in.
Yeah, he's a lot of fun. You really got at this kind of Falstaffian character.
I love him.
That's a lot of fun, and he has a great arc, I think, throughout the play as well. One of the themes that we get at through, especially the interplay between Rabelais and Calvin, is this, the idea of the body and what is the importance of the body, as in BODY. You also have commentary on BAWDY, so we have both types in this play. But I want to read a bit, kind of contrasting ideas from the play quickly. So towards the beginning, Calvin has this kind of commentary on grace and the body. He says, grace, yes, but grace to change, grace to turn this ruin of a man, a bodied thing, to good. St. Paul bids us wear our skins like garments, to be cast off at the end of the day. And when I fling mine off, I hope I'll find within not one thing I recognize. So he has kind of a skepticism towards the body, or a darker view of what that is, versus Rabelais has this very joyful view of the body and what it is, and appreciation for what life is, even if it's not necessarily a fully Christian view of the body. He has some part of that. So can you talk a little bit about kind of the exploration of this idea in the play?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I think it's kind of death to an artist to try to make something that's culturally relevant. You should make your art because you think it's beautiful. And if it happens to have some relevance, that's great. But I do think that, I mean, that said, there is a bit of a crisis about what we're supposed to do with our bodies mm-hmm. today. And you see, even among Christians, you see this push to transcend our bodies, whether through AI or uploading our consciousness or augmenting our physical bodies with complex surgeries, or just these things that sort of leave us questioning what is the purpose of this thing that it mediates all of our experiences. We know nothing mm-hmm. that doesn't come to us through the body, through our five senses, but also our body is going to die. It's going to decay and break down. And that's that is the human experience in a nutshell. We live in a house that's going to burn down. We just have that. And I think I don't know if that's always going to be the case. That's an interesting question. Will we ever reach the point where our bodies don't necessarily end, and where our bodies are made eternal, you know, on this plane and not waiting for the resurrection? But I think the crisis of the body, it feels very urgent and contemporary, but it's been going on forever. I mean, we've always had this question of what are we supposed to do with this thing that we inhabit? So at the Reformation, which is when this play takes place, I think a lot of the underlying tensions do actually have to do with the body. What role does our body play in worship? What role does our body play in sanctification? How about things like climbing the Spanish steps on your knees until your knees are shredded and bleeding? Well, the Protestants were saying, no, this isn't a good thing. And the Catholics were saying, we can atone for the world through our own physical suffering. And those were really heated questions. So I wanted to get into not necessarily the theology, because I'm not a theologian and I don't want to be making a theological argument, mm-hmm. but I wanted to bring the different perspectives on the body into conversation with each other, hopefully playful conversation, and just sort of let readers hopefully see a perspective that they hadn't seen before on the body. That's what I was trying to do.
Yeah, I think that's a really helpful distinction that you made between like making an argument versus kind of an exploration of ideas or an unfolding of ideas. Sometimes people think of every art form needs to be like a formal logical argument for X opinion. That's how we think about art often. I think it couldn't be more wrong. I mean, syllogism is going to be much more effective if you just want to make an argument or, you know, rhetoric. But I think you're playing with different ideas in a way that I think we can see unfold and think about in a helpful way.
Well, and there's an interesting thing there with arguments and art, if I can just jump in. Carl Dennis is a contemporary poet and critic, and he has this contention that every poem is making an argument, but that the argument that it's making is not some kind of abstracted logical argument. Instead, it's making an argument about what is important in reality that we need to pay attention to. It's saying this is a thing that you need to look at. And that is an argument. Mm-hmm. It's making an argument about where our attention should go. And I like that idea because I think sometimes people think of art either as what you're saying, this sort of ideological, we've created an art piece that advances an agenda. Or sometimes they think of it on the flip side as this is a purely personal expression. And that's not true. Neither of those are true. Instead, art is making a claim. a claim about where you should be basically putting your love. Every piece of art is saying, this is what you should be doing with your love. But it's not doing that in sort of that abstracted treatise fashion, or like saying like, this is the political conclusion you should reach or something like that. I don't know if that distinction makes sense, but I think it's an important distinction.
Yeah, in some sense, every piece of art is saying, look at this thing is good, beautiful, worthy of your attention. And so that is kind of the underlying tacit argument that it's making about just the nature of the world.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really good.
Yeah, Dennis is great on this if you are interested in it. He's got a book called Poetry and Persuasion, and it's just really, really fascinating.
Yeah, I'll definitely look that up. That's great.
Poetry as Persuasion? I think it's Poetry as Persuasion, sorry.
Great. Yeah, back to this question of kind of the crisis of the body, because I think you're right that it's not a new crisis. This is just the human experience, what we don't have bodies, we are bodies. This is how we experience the world. What we're seeing now, it seems, is kind of that same existential angst about what the body is. But now we have the technology to be able to tinker with the body to a larger extent. So I think that kind of heightens or speeds up this sense of disembodiment, of removal from, you know, where we are. And this the way you kind of bring us back to thinking about the body is kind of through a certain type of humor, you know, body humor. Rabelais has just a great way of kind of not quite shocking us, not a full shock, but just kind of playing with us to get us to think more about the body in a way that I think is helpful in our current age. Tell me more about your thoughts on his perspective on the body and kind of where you fell there what made you think of him as the interlocutor for those ideas?
Yeah. Probably many listeners haven't read Rabelais, and that's fine. I'm not sure everyone should rush out and buy Rabelais and try to read him. He's a difficult cup of tea. But he was famous for his just dirty writing. There's not a page that you could read at the dinner table. It's ridiculous. I mean, his most famous work is this massive combined novel called Gargantua and Pantagruel, and it's 1,000 pages long, and it is just wildly obscene. And there's a lot of different theories about what he's doing with that. It's basically to give a rough plot structure. It's the adventures of these two generations of giants who are moving through the world, and they're being educated in the classical liberal tradition in Paris. And then they have all these little, they go to war and they get married, and so they just kind of have, it's just the story of their lives, but told in these, I mean, there's one section where it's a 5-page list of book titles from one of the libraries, and they're all dirty puns on existing medieval texts. So they're just these, it's hysterical. But it's also, you get, you know, 2.5 pages in and you're like, oh my gosh, I have to do this for another 2.5 pages. So Rabelais was just this incredibly over the top, quirky guy. And everybody was kind of out to get him, both sides during the Reformation. Mm-hmm. The Protestants they were mad at him because he wouldn't leave the Catholic Church. The Catholics were always banning his books, and he kept losing patrons, and then he'd have to run around and find a new patron, or he would end up in big trouble, that kind of thing. So and like I said, there's all kinds of disagreements on what is his project, what is he doing? And I think that makes him kind of the perfect character to adjudicate the discussion between Calvin and Ignatius, because Rabelais is so deeply implicated here. He's considered guilty by both sides. So he kind of gets to just stand there and say, okay, you guys already hate me. So let's talk. You can't insult me any more than you already have. And obviously throughout the play, he's shown to be, he probably deserves some of this. Like, he's definitely not a pure character, but he's also not necessarily guilty of the things that everyone thinks he's guilty of, which is interesting. So he's just a really wild character. And I think I don't know that there is a Rabelaisian voice right now, but maybe there is, and we haven't recognized it for what it is. But I think that a Rabelais who could really write about the body today and what it means to have a body today would be quite an interesting. I know there's a couple of candidates out there, but I don't know if any of them have quite nailed it yet. But it would be a lovely thing, and I would be excited to see that person.
Yeah, you said earlier that this isn't a theological exploration, but you touch on theological themes. Let's maybe say it that way.
It is deeply theological, yeah.
So I want to read another quote, and this is three friends are sitting down for drinks, and Rabelais has this kind of toast that he gives, where I read it as kind of mocking the other two, kind of serious, as it's a line here. But he says, "Come, sit, drink, and then we'll dine. To what shall we drink? To women, wine, and song. We'll not go down easy in this throng. I think, and to the church, is no more the simple joy it was. To merest orthodoxy, the perseverance of the saints, the hope that grace may one day deign to paint our souls like theirs? Or shall we simply toast that gratuity of God, that most lurid, bloody, gross, exquisite, body thing, the resurrection of the body?" So tell us, why is the resurrection of the body body in the sense that Rabelais is using it?
I mean, I think once you really sit, it seems so when you first hear about it as a child, you and all the paintings and stuff, you get this idea of like, oh, well, I'll just kind of float up to heaven and we'll be wearing white and it'll be great. But then when you really start to think about it, or you spend some time in a graveyard, I have these little kids and they are strange. We like to go to graveyards. That's just something we like to do together. And my son, a couple of months ago when we were hanging out in a graveyard, he was standing next to a grave and he looked at me and he said, "Mama, is there a body down there?" I'm like, "Yeah, there's somebody buried there." And he said, "So it's probably just bones by now, right?" And I said, "Yeah, it's probably just bones," because it was from like 1870 or something. And he said, "That's really sad." And then he started talking about the resurrection of the body. And he was wondering, well, when the resurrection of the body comes, is it going to be just the bones that come up, or all these things? And I think that kind of childlike, like, oh, what is the process here? This is weird. Or, I mean, you think about our bodies are generally pretty worn out when we die. We're kind of gaunt, we're hunched over. And are we going to roll back through those processes? And these are the bodies that maybe we struggled with gluttony and we were overweight. Is that something where that's going to show up? And I know people say like, oh, our resurrected bodies will be perfect. But what is that going to mean? Because these are the bodies that we worked for salvation. You know, we worked towards sanctity through these bodies. I don't think they'll just be automatically perfect. I don't know what it's going to be. But it's a mystery, and it doesn't. I don't find it imaginatively satisfying that our bodies are just going to be perfect. No freckles, no moles, no nothing. I mean, that doesn't make sense with the way God works. God tends to carry faults through and make them holy instead of just eliminating them, if that makes sense.
Yeah, or another way to say it would be, we know we're going to be made perfect, but what is perfection in that in that setting? So, you know, what part of how we look now is going to, there's going to be some sort of continuity to be ourselves, to be the same person.
Yeah.
But what parts? What does that look like? You know, we know that Jesus' resurrected body had the marks of the crucifixion, and that was a type of perfection, not the way we usually think about perfection.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, we're not all going to look like airbrushed Instagram models. That's not
very boring world.
Yes. Yeah. So I think it's worth spending some time thinking about the resurrection of the body that way, and thinking about what of my body shows my salvation, because that's probably going to make it to heaven, you know, like stretch marks on a woman who's born children, like that's part of her salvation. And I don't think God's going to just kind of get rid of those. That doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm. Those distinctive qualities.
Yeah.
If you think about like I think of an older married couple who kind of teases each other about their quirks. They're not really teasing each other about their flaws. They, in some sense, aren't flaws anymore in some part of that process. I don't know how that works. Hopefully I'll get there someday. But, you know, that's really interesting how that works.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's kind of what I'm trying to get at there. Well, maybe. I don't really remember what my thought process was in writing that speech, but that's what I think about it now.
Wonderful. Yeah. I don't know if this is pushing back against one part or just getting more of your thoughts on it, but one theme throughout thinking about John Calvin, he seems to have a large amount of despair about kind of fate, or we could say predestination is what he's thinking about. Some of the reformers thought of this idea of all-powerful God deciding everything for us as incredibly comforting, as, you know, kind of this assurance of salvation. But in this kind of fictional world, Calvin has much more of an edge to how he thinks about fate. What was kind of a part of that decision to explore his character in that way?
Yeah, that's a really good question. The rendering of Calvin was actually the most difficult because he is such a archetypal figure in a lot of people's imaginations. Mm-hmm. There's, you know, Calvinism. And I wanted to make him a character. So he's actually the one who's most based on his biography, his sort of psychological biography, and where he was at this point in his life. He's quite young. He's the youngest of the three. And he was really, really struggling with super deep depression. In the play, I have him as an alcoholic. There isn't, you know, a ton of evidence that he was actually an alcoholic, but he did love to drink. We do know that. And I wanted to draw out that this was a major part of Calvin's story, was this period of despair that he experienced in this while he was in school. And some of it was, I mean, biographically, he kind of was pulled around a little bit and told, you know, this is going to be your career, and then this is going to be your career. So he was getting moved around by his family a lot, from sort of calling to calling. And I think that probably shows up in some of his ideas about fate at this point, where he feels like he doesn't have a lot of control over his destiny, and he's being pushed and pulled, and it doesn't matter what he does, because he can do as well as he can in a certain setting, but he could get yanked out of that setting and plopped someplace else with no warning. So I wanted with him, because I knew that, you know, some people just really, really adore Calvin, and some people really can't stand him. And I wanted to ground his character as much as possible in who Calvin really was at this point, and then let people kind of deal with that however they wanted to. And it's been interesting to see folks who are sort of anti-Calvinist, they tend to think I'm being too charitable to him.
Oh, interesting.
And folks who are super Calvinist tend to think, like, why are you just bringing out this dark side of his life and not giving us a more rounded picture? And it's really just because where the play is set, I picked a snapshot, and this is from my research where he kind of was. And obviously, you know, it's fiction. It's dramatically enhanced, but this is where he was in his life from what I can tell. So that's kind of why he's done the way he's done.
Yeah, I guess one thing I'm getting from what you're saying is that if we think about kind of the younger version of himself, there's maybe a larger amount of angst and openness to these types of debates.
Yes.
That definitely is a helpful way to see the play. If you think about college students debating, there's a different way that they would discuss this versus the established author who's writing the kind of treatise that's all laid out and things are decided. There's not really a lot that's in flux. But all the characters do have some kind of flux to them over the course of this play, which I think is helpful when you get at the dialectic of the back and forth and their conversation. So
yeah, they're all still trying to – I wanted to catch them before they were these famous figures and let and kind of give a peek at the development of the ideas that they would become known for. Like, this is the idea in its baby form.
Yes, I like that. As a kind of a meta point in here, you have a really interesting point that Rabelais makes. He makes it, I think, maybe two different points in the play. But this idea that when you have two people in a dialogue, there's kind of some proportionality to their back and forth. You can have the question and the response, and it seems like everyone's on fair ground. Versus when you have three, it always seems like there's one person who has the last word. I thought that was a really interesting point just on the structure of the play within the play. Can you tell me a little bit about where that idea came from?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of these ideas, I mean, and you, I mean, you probably heard this from other writers before. They don't really, you just start writing along and then one of your characters starts talking, especially with Rabelais. This guy, he just talks and talks, and I don't sit down and like plan what he's going to say. He just starts talking, and that's what you have.
And he has long speeches, so you can kind of see that in here too.
Yeah, he just goes on and on. I'm writing another play with him. This is actually the first of a trilogy of Rabelais plays. And this second play, he's just out of control. And I don't know. He's running amok at this point.
You need to add John Calvin back in there to keep him whipping into shape. I think that's the balance here, I think.
Yes, because his interlocutor in this next play is Death. Death, the figure. And Death just doesn't say a lot. So Rabelais just like runs on and on and on. And I have to figure out a better balance for them because they just, it's not balanced right now. But to your thing about the three-way conversation, I think Rabelais just was really getting frustrated with the way that these two are trying to go back and forth and back and forth and expecting to find some kind of, that one of them is going to triumph. Mm-hmm. I think that he's frustrated by that. And he says, well, this is ridiculous. And I think he, in some way, he's kind of lauding the three-way conversation in a sideways thing here, because he's saying in a three-way conversation, you don't have the opportunity for someone to just beat someone else down, because you always have that third voice that can come in and disrupt everything. And obviously the three-way conversation is a staple of philosophy. And then you have the thesis, the antithesis, the synthesis. You also have the running conversation between the three parts of the Trinity. It really is a huge it's a huge theme in Western thought, just in how you reach truth, is that there's kind of always three. Making Rabelais sort of, I don't know if he's being ironic, but I think he might be being ironic and actually praising the three-way conversation here in term, as opposed to the two-way. This is a passage people always love. They always want to come back to and read this passage and talk about it. And I honestly just wrote it. I mean, I think I wrote it at like 2 a.m. one day, and it's people's favorite section. It's funny.
That's great. No, I think that's the kind of Trinitarian dialogue is helpful for these types of conversations. So I appreciated that. I want to turn a little bit to kind of the time of year we're in, because this is a good time of year to be talking about this play as we're in Lent currently. For listeners, the play happens kind of on the cusp between Carnival and Lent. So we have this kind of, you call it, Jaina, a bridge between two times. And, you know, we're currently in the season of Lent. So how does this specific time in the church calendar kind of frame their conversation?
Yeah, so the play starts right after Vespers on Shrove Tuesday, on Fat Tuesday, and then they basically have all night until Ash Wednesday starts. So it's like the last bit of Carnival. And I think something we don't really have a sense of Carnival. We don't mm-hmm. we've lost that. We don't have the sense of what Carnival was. And some of that I think has to do with our abstraction from the body. But Carnival was a lot more than just, oh, we're going to go have a crazy party. It was that for sure. But it was almost more of a, we're going to acknowledge the physicality of our salvation and of our damnation. So we're going to acknowledge that the spiritual things that the church is telling us are happening are also happening through our bodies. So you'd have plays and you tons of plays. Drama and Carnival go together really well. Traditionally, people would always be putting on plays during Carnival. You'd have costumes and you'd have these parades, you'd have people staying up all night. And some of the traditions from Carnival they really shock us. So for example, there was kind of a Carnival joke where someone would take all the passages from the Bible that have to do with defecation or sex, string them together and stand in the public square and just read all the like kind of obscene passages from the Bible in a line. That's all that they would do. And people would just gather and laugh. They would think it was so funny. Or you'd have these like mock sermons where people would get together and do like a really grotesque, obscene parody of the Sermon on the Mount and would like preach a sermon based on it in the public square as just completely a joke with like tons of Latin puns and all this stuff. And you see this kind of almost giving like a gravitational pull to spiritual realities and like saying like, no, these things do sink into the world in a way. And a resisting of the Gnostic tendency to just abstract things. Now, obviously lots of bad things happened in Carnival too. So we don't have to, you know, go back and say everyone should get drunk all the time, but there's something about Carnival that we don't have the contrast anymore. Mm-hmm. So we kind of go, you know, we all just, I mean, people used to not work for a lot of Carnival because it's the middle of winter. So you could have periods of several weeks where everyone was off work, just wandering around partying in the cities. And you transition from that to, okay, it's Lent. The Lenten penances were much stricter, partly because they simply didn't have food anymore at that point in the winter. So there just wasn't much to eat. Mm-hmm. And that contrast, it's kind of like a cold bath or a cold shower of damnation comes through the body and salvation comes through the body. And your spirit is in many ways following your body. Obviously, your body follows your spirit. You learn spiritual strengths. It teaches your body. But you can't have a lazy body and a strong spirit, you know? Mm-hmm. Your spirit imitates your body in a lot of ways. And we don't think that way anymore, but the medievals knew that. So that's kind of what I'm trying to show here, is that just give us a little taste of that really marked contrast that Christendom had and we just don't have anymore.
Yeah, you use the term the cold plunge or the cold shower, hot and cold shower. That, of course, is a French drama principle. That's great here in this context. Yeah. But also, so the moral contrast is something that it doesn't seem like we have. It's not like, oh, now people who are more secular have this kind of Carnival atmosphere. It just seems like it's no one has it. It's just kind of lost to everyone.
We just work all the time.
Exactly. Yeah. There's work, and there's some people who are trying to maintain a constant kind of pleasure high. You have that that as a principle, which of course is extremely deadening over time. And then other people who are kind of have a more stoic way of kind of viewing the world. So this is a helpful, I think, contrast to us as we think about Lent and how it has to do with the body.
So, and this wasn't the only carnival period either. There's other carnival periods that we've completely lost. Like, we have a little bit of this one, but there was a big carnival period in the summer around the summer solstice and the feast of St. John the Baptist. And then there was a significant carnival period in the fall around Michaelmas, that sort of thing. It was very much more of a throughout the year you'd have this rising and falling instead of boom, everything on Fat Tuesday. And mm-hmm. even the carnival season that we think of as Fat Tuesday, it stretched from Epiphany to Shrove Tuesday. So you had weeks and weeks of carnival instead of this all compressed into after work on Fat Tuesday. And it's just a very different way to live.
Absolutely. Good. Well, is there any other kind of passage of the play that you want to leave us with, or other any other thoughts?
It's a good question. I really like the last speech, I'll read a little bit of it.
Please do.
So Rabelais left. He's left on stage by himself. The other two have exited with their own speeches, and he is left alone, which he obviously has thoughts on being left alone, but we'll skip those for now. He says, "So what's my scene? A woman dead, a score of night watchmen dismayed, one friend outraged, another friend embroiled, and I, Rabelais, jesting as all sparks fly. Ignatius speaks of battle pitched, and Jean, he hopes I'm killed in it, but I jest on. For jesting's still a noble art, at least as noble as war or reading creased books in dusty halls of learning. Love wisdom, say I, but not with what's above. She's a pretty girl and ripe. Love her with your body, your skin and bones, the gurgle of your gut. Love her with your rutting heart." And I like those lines. Again, when I read them, I think like, oh, I don't feel like I wrote those. I feel like someone else did. But I like those lines because I think intuitively we think of wisdom as abstracted. And that's not the way it's written about in the Bible. That's not the way it's written about in Christendom. Wisdom and salvation are things that are they're imminent. They're incarnated. And I would love to, I don't know, I'm still learning what that means, but I would love to see more and more people talking about that element of salvation.
Wonderful. Good. Well, we will leave it there. But thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, this was so fun. Thanks a ton.
And for our listeners, the play is Sonele Mattina, out from Wise Blood Books, and we'll put the link in the show notes. So thanks for joining us today.
Fantastic.
As always, thank you for listening. Our team loves putting this podcast together for you. It's encouraging to hear from our listeners. Feedback is incredibly important to us because it lets us know what you'd like to hear more of, including the kinds of topics you're interested in most. If you have comments, feedback, or ideas for a show topic or interesting guest, you can email our team at producer@acton.org. Until next week, for Acton Line, I'm Eric Cohn.